Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
And welcome to this very, very late getting started edition to the War Report. I needed probably four shows to cover today's topic. And so I was in a panic in terms of how I was going to do it in 55 minutes. Now I'm even worse panicking that I only have probably about 40, 47 minutes. Let me get right to it. The title of today's show, dealing with the origins of the rightness of whiteness, value syndrome. In 71, I had finished all my classes, taken all my exams, presented my proposal for my final major project, my dissertation, and defended it, the oral rationale for it, and et cetera. And I had started collecting data, and when you do empirical research, you usually do a small sampling of your target population, testing out the validity of your instrument, the questionnaire, and all of that other stuff. Doing that, collecting the data, I was working from a premise. This was 1971, the Supreme Court decision of 1954 declaring separate and equal unconstitutional was influenced quite a bit by a set of studies that came out of the late 1930s and early 40s. Two social psychologists, Kenneth and Mamie Clark, two black researchers, came up with this notion of testing kids, black and white, to see their pattern of racial identity, racial preference, individual identity, and it was fairly basic but very effective. The Supreme Court justice at the time cited in his writing for the majority that it was the Clark studies that persuaded him more than anything that segregation, separate but equal, was so harmful, so damaging to the minority community that on its face it had to be declared unconstitutional. This was landmark. I was going to replicate this study, and my contribution to my discipline, to science, was that I was going to develop a research theory, actually a premise, and I was also going to add a third racial group to my sample, and I was going to increase the age. They went up to age 7. I went to 8. They started around 4. I went to 3. So, and my premise was this, was that the civil rights movement, by the time I was doing this, was 12, 13, 14 years old. And one of the main theories or themes, I should say, themes of the movement was black power, and black is beautiful, and particularly black is beautiful, countering the hundreds of years that blackness was ugliness, and black was inferior, and et cetera. And so my premise was that given this, that I would expect that black children would begin to identify racially and would begin to prefer blackness and countering the centuries-long teaching of black people that they needed to be white, or the what I would call the rightness of whiteness. My sample did not show that. I was, like, devastated. So I was forced to reformulate and use what is called a null hypothesis, which basically stated there would be no difference in what my subjects displayed along these dimensions that I was measuring and what previous research has discovered. When I was working on this, I kept saying, why? Did I make a mistake? Should I have waited, or someone should have waited 15 years, 20 years, to see whether or not Black is Beautiful had permeated the socialization, the culturalization of black people? I was floundering, trying to come up with a rational, theoretically supportable idea. And believe me, you're not going to believe what I'm about to say. I flashed one night on something that happened when I was 4 years old. Yes, folks, I remember some of the things back then. We were in our living room, and I've mentioned in the past that our house was like Grand Central for my parents, relatives, and friends from down home and what have you. And it was this gathering of black men and women, and they were talking about something, but they got on racial treatment of blacks and et cetera. And one of them said, if you are white, you're all right. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, stand back. And everyone laughs and said, yeah, amen, and all this other stuff. And remembering that, it was, if you're white, you're all right. That just kept running through my head. I started playing with it. And what I came up with was that the culture of American society was so steeped in whiteness being superior, whiteness being the end of all everything, that blackness being so vilified that the Black Power movement, the Black is Beautiful, was not able to penetrate and alterate the power of that ideology. And hence, what I concluded was that the ideology that I call a syndrome, the rightness of whiteness value syndrome, was the reason why I didn't find black kids embracing their blackness and instead continuing to prefer whiteness. That would lead me to develop a theory that you now call a framework, concepts, and vocabulary to explain this rightness of whiteness value syndrome. And I use syndrome just like it is used in medical work. A syndrome is a set of symptoms that consistently occur together, or a condition characterized by associated symptoms or conditions, or a characteristic combination of opinions, emotions, behavior, attitudes, value, belief. They are maybe individual, but they, in combination, they share similar characteristics, thus making it a syndrome. The word ideology is much more relevant to what we're talking about here than syndrome, but they are almost interchangeably or could be argued to be interchangeable. And so I use whiteness is rightness. Anything white is right. Behavior, attitudes, beliefs, religion, style of living, you name it, the history, the culture, everything was framed around this ideology that whiteness is rightness. And so I, of course, inverted it to say the rightness of whiteness. Anything that white people do, and this was a universal idea in the making, coming out of Europe, of course, but spreading around the globe, that anything that white people did was essentially good, including racial discrimination, racial prejudice, racial exploitation. It didn't matter. It was all good. It was all right. And so I began from that point to study, develop, and work on my thing called the rightness of whiteness as a set of ideology. It's, say, the standard of beauty. It's what is meant to be human and also non-human, intelligence versus ignorance. You know what I'm talking about. So, if you are white, you're all right. And so, thus began my work. And looking at the origins, you know, again, by that time, I'm what, mid-20s, I think, 20, 25 or something like that, and I've been studying what we call then race and ethnic relations ever since my junior year, which made it somewhere, maybe I was around 20 or so, and I came across all kinds of stuff. So let me just, my time is going to be very, very short, and I'm truncating this, and I hope I don't mess it up because I have such little time to work with. But what I came up with was this. The rightness of whiteness was, big time word today is intersectionality. It was the intersection of racial theology of the period, later scientific racism, notions of empire, and all of these ideas, beliefs would come together over decades, maybe a century, to foster the notion that whiteness was superior to all other human colors, black, brown, yellow, whatever was out there, whiteness was superior. And that was the reason why 12 years, 10 years, 12 years, 11 years wasn't enough time for black is beautiful to take hold. Now, what am I talking about in terms of this racial ideology? It wasn't called a racial ideology at the time. But going back to ancient Greece, Aristotle, and those almost all of us who went through college, maybe took a philosophy course, and we know about the Greeks and philosophy, and Aristotle is one of the biggies. Aristotle came up with his philosophy of human hierarchy, which basically said Greeks were superior to non-Greeks. And he worked out a theory which was, you know, pretty damn good for back in his day, that basically was used to justify Greek superiority. Yes. Here, let me restate that. Aristotle comes out with a theory that basically says that the Greeks were superior to non-Greeks. That included white people that were non-Greeks. He advanced his theory, and the Romans would also embrace his theory that Romans were superior to all non-Romans. And of course, that would include the people that they knew about in their day, which included Africans. Let's fast forward. The Puritans in England, they would use Aristotle and the Romans' theories or politics to justify their idea that Puritans and their beliefs were superior to non-Puritans. And of course, that would include their fellow white English and Irish and et cetera, but also all the other known, quote, races or civilization of their time. And so that you would have a sort of a marriage of what came out of ancient Greece and Rome into a philosophy and, more importantly, into a theology. Puritans, of course, you know, I'm assuming you know that they were a religious sect, and they considered themselves Puritans to be the pure religious belief. And so we have here, Puritans are superior to everyone else, including their fellow countrymen. But when they get to America, they consider themselves superior to Native Americans, African people, Anglicans, all non-Puritans they were superior to. They used the Aristotle justified superiority, Greek superiority, to substantiate their claim. It would be a claim based upon what we would today call climate theory, dealing with extreme heat or extreme climate produce intellectually, physically, morally superior, inferior people who were ugly, lacked the capacity for freedom, self-governance, and of course, you know who they would be eventually talking about. That would be the Africans. So, we have here Greek and Romans use climate theory to justify their slaveholding interests. And yes, you know, Greeks and Romans had slaves, people that they conquered, they would enslave. The Puritans would follow in suit. And they would come up with what I guess could be called their Christian theology, Puritan's Christian theology, that God ordained the human, a human hierarchy, that it was based upon three categories: heavenly masters, early masters, and enslaved people. And of course, the enslaved people would turn out to be first the Native Americans and then the Africans. And I just made a big assumption that you are following me in terms of early American colonial history. The Puritans played a big role in the development of the Virginia colony. Okay, and so hence they came in with the idea that they were superior to the Native Americans. And then when the first black Africans came in 1619, the Puritans, I think, came to Virginia 1607, they already had this ideology of they were superior to anyone who was not a Christian in the Puritan tradition. I'm rushing, people. Please stay with me. Bear with me. And so what we would have here is this theory that developed that would justify white superiority. There would be a second theory that would come about called the curse theory or Noah's curse. It goes very quickly something like this. Noah's son, Ham, had sex with a black woman, and Noah put a curse on him. And it went something like the fact that Ham and slavery became tied. God inflicted on Ham's descendants a curse. The curse of blackness and the curse of slavery, and ugliness, of course. So you have the Puritans being a really very serious religious group. You have the introduction here of religious theology, which would play a huge role in the development of the social, cultural norms, beliefs, values of the early, quote, colonists, early Americans. And you would have a rival theory of the climate theory from the Greek and the Romans, and the curse theory of religion or theology. And this would sort of set the stage for how the Native Americans and then later the Africans would be viewed. And as you, if you can recall from our first show in this series, when I talked about the how the Africans, when they was first let off on the shores of Virginia, some were considered indentured servants, some would be considered but not formally stated as slaves, slave in perpetuity. Some would rise to freedom after a term of years, and some would become prominent. Some would even become slaveholders themselves. Some would become involved in the judicial system, the legislative process, and all. And that all of this would undergo a radical change by the 1660s into the 1670s. And so we're talking here about the origins of what we today call racism, racist thoughts, racist ideology. And I'm suggesting, and no, I'm basically saying that when the Pilgrims and the Puritans landed upon the shores of what we now call America, they brought with them centuries of ideas that would form their beliefs, their opinions, and later their laws that would enshrine their superiority and enshrine whiteness superiority over all other colors, particularly the Native Americans, red, and the African, black. And so this would set the stage. And I'm truncating this, people. I am so sorry. And I mentioned in that first episode that despite what the Africans and then their descendants had achieved and their contribution to the colonies surviving and beginning to thrive, their contributions in war and wars with the native population and their integration into the colony, intermarriage, raising families, becoming property owners, slave owners, and et cetera. By the 1660s into the 70s, a lot of this would change. You would begin to get, in Virginia, laws that would change the status of the African and then his African-American descendant and would start snowballing towards slavery as a permanent condition that would be passed from mother to child, generation after generation into perpetuity. This would arguably be very supportive of the idea that race is a social construct. There's nothing given in biology and genetics. And it would also support the idea that slavery and the perception of the worth of value or the valuelessness of blackness are all social constructs, all practices, concepts and practices that would develop. And they would all develop just like in Aristotle's days in Greek and in Rome. They would develop as an ideology to support the interest of the equivalent of the period's elite, or the 1%. They would develop ideas and practices and laws to justify the enslavement of, and here on the colonies, the Native Americans, and then the African and African American. Religion or theology played a humongous role in all of this. One Puritan, Mathis, came over on the Mayflower as a religious leader of the Puritans. He and his descendants into third or fourth generations, all would become clergy, all would become extremely powerful, influential, and they would prophesize or spread the idea that Native Americans and the African and African Americans were inferior, but they should be baptized, should be made Christian. And they would spend decades pushing this ideology of, yes, these other groups are inferior. Matter of fact, it goes even further than that in terms of that, even if you were white, if you weren't a Christian Puritan, you would be considered inferior. But they would push this. This would become part of the cultural and social norm of the time. and clearly of the present day. This is part of the 400-year history of the birth of this country, 1607, and then the arrival of the African in 1619. We are today, tomorrow, all of next week, next month, are still operating as a society under the ideas, the values, religious belief, economic belief that were embraced by the Puritans and eventually embraced by the economic power structure that supported slavery or black slavery in support of their self-interest. And here's something that I have to get in, even though I'm running out of time. We have these two theories, the curse theory and the climate theory. They were political theology in a true sense of the word. But later, there would become the philosophical racism. And this blew me away, folks. John Locke. Now, I'm assuming that if you were in college in liberal arts, you took a philosophy class or even a European history class, you know about John Locke, one of the most celebrated philosophers of his time and up to and beyond the present day. He was a racist. You remember I talked about the books, one called The Lies My Teacher Told Me. The other was The Truth Never Been Told. And the third one was We Can't Teach What We Don't Know. John Locke was a classic example of all three of those. He embraced and promulgated a philosophy of racial hierarchy with white / Europeans being at the very top, of course, of the hierarchy, and blackness being at the very bottom. I don't know about you, but in my study of philosophy, and I love philosophy, I took more than the one course requirement. I took several courses in philosophy. I never, never ran across a statement, a paragraph, a page, anything that showed John Locke's contribution to the development of races, society, social structure, cultural laws, history, political economy. Not a single word did I find. And I was a pretty good student, and I love philosophy. I'm going to kind of bet that those of you, again, who liberal arts majors or liberal arts studies, that in your freshman, sophomore year, you took a history course or a history / civilization course, Western civilization course, philosophy. I'm going to bet that you didn't run across this part of John Locke's historical status as one of the greatest philosophers of all time. It blew me away when I discovered this some few years back. And I had to get this in, that Locke supported and advanced, using his incredible stature, the notions of racial superiority, with whites being superior to all other groups, and that part of Europe, and I laugh only because this is a whole nother show, but Southern Europe, the Italians, the Germans, Slavics, you name it, were all considered inferior to the French, the Spanish, the English, the Northern Europeans, and they were part of this racial hierarchy. They were maybe one step above the African, but they were considered inferior. I had to get that in. There's another. So we have religion creating or supporting and advancing a racial hierarchy theory, philosophy, principles that basically support the notion that whiteness is the human standard, the standard for human beings, and that whiteness, as I termed it, was rightness. And so that becomes one leg. The second leg was the philosophical racism, and I picked John Locke. There were others, but picked John Locke because I'm assuming almost all of us would know about John Locke. The third leg was scientific racism, like a pre-eugenic pseudoscience, that scientists, and science was beginning to become a science, become a field of study with methodology, with theory. And scientists of the 1600s, the 1700s, were also individuals and groups that advanced either the climate theory or the curse theory, or a third theory that all would say that whiteness is rightness, whiteness is the symbol of the highest form of human development, and all other races / colors were inferior, that whiteness was the basis of supremacy and a belief in white supremacy. So you would have the three legs here of this notion coming into being that white people were the superior people on the planet, and justification for enslaving the Native Americans in this country, the imported African Americans, and then the exploitation of other people around the world as the Europeans, especially the Spanish and the Portuguese, and then later the English and other countries began to explore the planet looking for more resources to bring back to the motherland, and so that England would become equal to Spain or Portuguese or Portugal or Portuguese people in terms of power, influence, and literature, culture, and etc. So we have here the making of like a three-leg stool that would support what would become racism legally, culturally, socially, philosophically, religiously, that white people were superior to non-whites. But now there's a caveat here. Not all white people, because there were the indentured servants who were white coming from England. There were white slaves in other parts of the world. And so that you would have this ideology growing, festering, and then, and I'm rushing folks back here in the colonies, there would rise up a rebellion, the Beacon or Bacon Rebellion, where poor whites who were indentured servants would join with blacks who were slaves or indentured servants or even free to basically try and overthrow the power elite of the colony of Virginia. This is important, and I touched on it in our first show. This becomes, in my view, extremely important. The rebellion failed, but after some serious gains and successes. And from the aftermath of the rebellion, the white power elite looked around and said that they were so outnumbered, I'm paraphrasing here, folks, they were so outnumbered that they needed to create a buffer between the elite and the peasantry of the colony. And they created, from the rebellion, a class of white people who would be in a position superior to the slaves, superior to Native Americans, and that these white people would enjoy a degree of political freedom and marginal economic freedom that the slaves and the Native Americans would not enjoy. They created this class. It's not, you could call it the working class, precursor to the working class, but it was a class that they felt that would serve between them and future rebellion, the future coming together of whites with blacks, Native Americans, because the poor whites would be given a special class of their own. They weren't nowhere near equal to the ruling class or the economic religious class, but they would be over or superior to the slaves, and be it black or Native American. That's important because it would be the creation of this class from the Beacon Rebellion that would remain in existence up until this day. And it's that class, you call them hillbillies now, you call them poor whites, rednecks, hicks in Virginia, coal mining country, Deep South, you name it. They created that class to serve as a buffer between them and the rising African population and the ongoing wars with the Native Americans. And to this day, that class that they created, we know them today as the descendants who voted for Trump. I'm quiet because I want that to soak in. That class is the descendants of the whites of Virginia colony that brought in the slaves, the free blacks, to form a rebellion and to see to it that that large group of whites would not be so inclined to join with the slave population that was growing by leaps and bounds because the economy was flourishing. They created this class, hence our class structure that we have today. And all of this, and I'm truncating, folks, all of this emanated from, first, the economic exploitation, the theological racism, and I really don't have time to go into the preachers, the theologians who promulgated this racist ideology that would support the status quo then and their mission to spread Christianity. It's, you're talking about connecting dots. It's there. I just made a decision that because we got started so late and I'm rushing so much, that I'm going to extend Black History Month into the first week of March. I'm feeling totally guilty here about the way in which I'm rushing through this very important episode. This period and what we're talking about here literally and figuratively set the stage to where we are today in, quote, America's race relations and also America's white dominant political, socioeconomic, philanthropic, financial elite waging war globally. I would argue it emanates from this period and the Beacon Rebellion. And that then, of course, you know, the Republican Party was first the Lincoln Party and then the Democrats. And then the Democrats became what Republicans were. And when Johnson signed over, started signing the Civil Rights legislation, and the Republicans became the party that went after the white Southern vote, the Southern strategy, the same people that Trump appealed to then when he was running, when he was elected, now emanates from that period between 1619 when the Native Americans were here. They posed a threat to the survival of the colonists, the introduction of the Africans, and then later the African Americans, the keeping of the indentured servitude practice. All this come to a head in this Beacon Rebellion, and the reaction by the colonial powers after they succeeded in putting down the rebellion through trickery and some other stuff, guarding against future possibilities of poor whites and poor blacks, either free or slave, coming together again, forming a army big enough to challenge the economic political elite emanates from that period of the 1660s and 70s and the Beacon Revolution. The religious political theology helped set the stage. Political philosophy helped set the stage. And I don't have time to get into the role of medical or what would be the forerunner to eugenics, scientific ideology contributing to all of this, and get in more into white rage that we see today. So I'm going to redo this show, folks. I have to. I have no choice. My time is up. I am so sorry that we got started so late, and I'm really disappointed, but I'll do my best to make up for it. Have a good rest of this day, Sunday, everyone, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.